Shalom Aleichem, Chaver. This is Binyamin Hammer at the National Council of Young Israel. We welcome Rebbe for Shaila's with Rebbe Willig, number 59. I would like to just preface before we begin to wish Rebbe Mazel Tov. I understand there's a bar mitzvah of a grandchild this Shabbos, so we wish you a Mazel Tov as well. Rebbe, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Question one. Is there an easier to draw the sun, moon, or mazalos? Does it matter if it is a professional picture or a diagram for school? Is there a problem of printing a picture of the sun, moon, or mazalos? Yoredeya Simen Kufmem Aleph Sivdalet says one may not draw even a two-dimensional picture of the sun or the moon or the mazalos. Pesachei Tshuva explains that a painting is the equivalent of what the Gemara calls shokas. You may not even, not only may you not draw it, you may not even own it. A diagram, if it does not approximate the real thing, would presumably be permissible. But printing is no heter. The Taz there in end of Sifkot Yud Gimel says that the machzorin, the print the mazolos and tefilas geshem, is in violation of this prohibition, even though it's only referring to printing. The only possible heter is something which is called mevuza. You look in Shulchan Aruch and Siv Gimel, there is a heter of mevuza, something which is not honorable, but rather is something which is, has no dignity to it, it's not dignified. And the logic behind it is that the fundamental prohibition over here is in owning something is lest you come to chashad, you'll be suspected of actually worshipping. Today, if it's davar mevuza, we don't worship it, and therefore there'd be no reason to prohibit. In Chayodim, it appears, Chok Masodim, that nowadays, that people do not bow down to these things anymore, there are certain additional leniencies. This is quoted by the Sefer Oz Nidbru, Rabbi Benjamin Zilber, as a possible heter to some of these prohibitions. Unfortunately, in the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't sound that way. It sounds that way that in Siv Gimel, the heter mevuza applies to something which is found, but not to draw it and not to even keep it. So it's a problem. But it is a significant issue. We should try our best to avoid doing these things because, it, according to most authorities, it's prohibited. And in Shas HaTzchak, if it's considered to be mevuza, there's room to be more lenient. Question two. Is there any reason to hear Parsha Zohar in a different pronunciation, i.e. Sephardic, Yemenite, etc.? Every person is required to hear Parsha Zohar, if possible, in his own pronunciation, his own Havara. Rav Moshe passes this way in our Chaim Chelek Gimel Simen Ches. The Chatchila, a person should not stray from his own personal Havara. However, B'di'evet, Rav Moshe writes there, you can be Yotze with any Havara, because any Havara, by definition, is considered to be a proper Havara, and the proof Rav Moshe brings is from Chalitza. Chalitza can be, requires Lashon HaKodesh, and Chalitza can be pronounced in many different ways. Baradit, Ashkenazis, and there can be the Taimani as a different pronunciation. And although the Kriya is not Me'akev, you need Roar of the Kriya. So a person who cannot pronounce certain Yemenite letters, for example, an Ayin and a Het and all the various different consonants, that means such an individual, the chalitza would be no good. That's an impossible conclusion to come to. So it must be that it's kosher b'di'evit. But nonetheless, the chatchila, you should find your own havara. Mikroi Kodesh, Purim Simen Zayim says the same thing. We don't find an inyan to hear other havaros. In Karen B'Avna, there was a custom that they used to read Parsha Zochar in many, many havaros, but presumably the reason for that was that there were many people in the audience, and each one wanted to hear his own Havarah, Ashkenazi, Sfaradit, Taimanit, and many others. So therefore, that's why it was done, just to accommodate everybody to be the Chatchila. But for myself, that I hear, I use Ashkenazi, for me to go Dafka to hear it in Sfaradit, there's no such requirement. Question three. Is there a shayla with a bar mitzvah bechal leining parsha zochah for his bar mitzvah? Very serious question. Parsha zochah, according to Shulchan Aruch, simen tofresh pehei sif zayin, is a doraisa. And if you look in the Mikroi Kodesh, in Purim, in the footnote, end of Simon Aleph, he says that bar mitzvah bechal should not be given the aliyah, should not read parsha zochah. Why? The fact that we assume that every boy of 13 is really a gadol is not required merely 13 years, it requires shonim v'simonim, that to be two pubic hairs to prove that he should be considered to be a gadol. So we generally assume that it's true, because of chazaka de rava, but in Baba Basra, Kuflan Vav, we are taught, bodkin legerish and v'kidushin, which implies, there's more erevin about it too, that for a daraisa, you cannot rely on this chazaka. You have to check, and to check today is not something that you're about to do. Why don't we rely upon the chazaka derava for daraisa? So some quote the Ramban, who says it's efshel levarure. Whenever you can find something out, then you cannot rely on a rov. And some throw in that it's a mir tamotzi, the prima godim. But pashas, you need both of these reasons to explain why we don't rely on chazaka derava. Because when it comes to even the rices such as shchita, so we only do a bedika on a miyot hamotzi, the Ramban writes in the beginning of Masech Tachulin. So you need a bedika for a miyot hamotzi. Had it been either a miyot chen hamotzi or ef shel verure, we could be mekel. But because it's both, it's a miyot hamotzi and ef shel verure, we do not rely on the chazaka of the Rava, which is, it's really a Rov. Chazaka the Rava is a Chazaka above Mikta'at Mikoach Rov, Mikta'am Rov. The most 13-year-olds have achieved this level of physical maturity, but we try not to rely upon it when it comes to Doraisas, and since many say that Parsha Zacha is Doraisa, so the Bocha should not be laying in Parsha Zacha. Can you get an Aliyah for Parsha Zacha? That's not part of the question. The Psak Halacha is yes, even though, if you look there in Mikroi Kodesh, with a Yesh Mokom Lahachme, if you put together a couple of Chumras, is a prima godim and a taisus the Russian bracha setzvav, but we don't go that far to prohibit that. So a bacha can get the aliyah, he gets the aliyah, and someone who is a gadol for sure, his father or the rabbi or somebody, should read the parsha zachar for the shul. Question 4: is there a permissible way to do a casino night or a poker night at a shul as a fundraiser? Let me give you a story. I don't tell too many stories in this forum, but this story is worth repeating. When I was interviewed for my present position in Young Israel of Riverdale way back in November of 1973, I was asked, what is the responsibility of a Rav? So I answered, having been tipped off, a Rav is responsible to paskin all the shilas for the shul, for the community. And it's part of the Rav's mandate to decide what is a halachic shayla. So some of my friends have been telling me that they say, Rabbi, this is not a halachic shayla. We don't have to listen to you. So in my first interview, I said, whatever I say is halachic shayla by definition is, that's part of my responsibility. Sure enough, after I was elected, very shortly thereafter, they came through with a question, can they have one of these nights, a bingo night, where all the shul would do is put its name on it, and it would be able to receive profits from presumably goyim, gambling with goyim in a nearby community. I just needed a synagogue or from other religion to sponsor it officially, I guess for governmental tax reasons, etc., etc. I said, absolutely not. So I said, Rabbi, this is not really a halachic question. I said, you forgot what I said. The rabbi decides what is a halachic question. They were coming from a very narrow point of view. They worry about Easter Gzela. That maybe it's an Easter Gzela. So maybe they thought it comes to a goy is taken from a goy. There's no Easter Gzela in this kind of situation. We maybe call Asmachta Lokanya. Maybe they were even more learned and knew that in some cases there's not a problem of Asmachta, what's called Mol Saladaf, and every case is different. But I'm coming from a totally different place. Whether there is or is not an Easter of Gzela depends on the particular circumstances. What certainly exists, in my view, is a Chil Hashem, that a shul should try to make ends meet by profiteering off of gambling, which is a terrible vice. We all know how terrible gambling can be. It can destroy lives, it can destroy marriages, it can destroy even communities, as we've seen it happen. It's a terrible addiction, as Rabbi Dr. A.J. Twersky writes repeatedly. It's an addiction which we should do our best to try to eliminate. And by putting our name of any shul on a gambling night of this kind of situation where they're playing casino, poker, whatever they're doing, cards, it's something which no shul should do. Question 5. My shul davens Nusach Ashkenaz, but to reach out to Israelis and unaffiliated Sephardim in the area, wants to do one Shabbos of Nusach Eidot Mizrach. Is this permissible? We read this earlier, you are not permitted to change your Havara or your Nusach, not allowed. So the main shul has to continue to daven whatever its Nusach happens to be. Nonetheless, it's perfectly permissible to establish a separate minyan for these individuals, Eidot HaMizrach, different Havara, different Nusach. No problem. That should be done to reach out to Israelis and unaffiliated Sfarim in the area. At the same time, the main minyan has to maintain its original minhagim. Question 6. Guidelines for families that have to deal with family members marrying out RL, Rahman al-Islam. How should they deal with both the family member and the non-Jewish spouse? Can they be included in family gatherings? Is there a difference in how to deal with it before marriage and after marriage? This is one of the most painful issues that we have to deal with in our time, unfortunately. It wasn't that long ago that intermarriage was a tiny, tiny phenomenon, a very, very, very tiny percentage. As we know today, in the Jewish community at large, unfortunately, it's a majority. Rachman al-Hassan, the majority of Jews in America intermarry. So it's terrible. It's terrible. And in the olden days, even not that olden, people who would have someone, a relative, marry out, they would erase him from the family lists. People didn't even know he existed. You know, in my wife's family, there was she had a great uncle. She did not know he existed because he married out, and her grandfather and the remaining firm brother never spoke about him. And as far as she knew, he did not exist. Much later in life, she discovered it was this other brother that they existed, etc., etc. That's how it was. They would even, as you know, observe Shiva for someone who married out in many instances. Very sad, but it happened even then. It was a very tiny percentage. And someone who married out those days knew what he was doing. He knew he was going against the tradition to marry only Jewish people, which goes back thousands of years. He was overtaken by love or lust, whatever you want to call it. And he basically did something to be considered traitorous to the people of Israel. Because everyone knew at the time that marrying out was the worst possible thing to do for a Jewish person. Today, that the majority marry out, most of the people who are doing so are in the category of Tinok Shenishba. They don't even know it's appropriate. What's the problem? What's the problem? All human beings have a Tzelem Elokim. What's the problem? They don't see anything wrong with it. A good person, ethical, moral, kind, gentle. What's wrong? And even if someone will tell them, don't do this, as the Rambam writes in a different context in Hilchos Mamre and Perek Gimel, if they weren't brought up properly, they may be viewed as a tinah shenishba, even if later on someone tells them that it's against the Jewish law to do what they're doing. This applies to many, I would say by now, most of those who intermarry, that we have to treat them in that fashion as tinah shenishba, which could, of course, change the way we deal with them. Perhaps, as the Rambam says in a different context in Hilchos Mamre, we should try to bring them closer to us, even those who are intermarried. This is something which requires a case-by-case analysis. You can't just say one rule for every single situation. I recently read that about 60 years ago, someone approached Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal with such a question, and he responded, even then, 60 years ago, by quoting the Pasuk, "Mibsorcha al tisalem." You're not permitted to stay away from your flesh and blood, even in the most drastic of circumstances. There's a famous story of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, who came to a town and he stayed by a cousin of his who was not from the most distinguished members of the community. And they asked him, why aren't you staying with the rabbi, with the Pnei, with the most distinguished people? He said, B'psoch al tesalem. And they said to him, but Rebbe, it says, Zochein v'enel v'fi chvodo, pomem sha'ata misalem. Sometimes there's someone who's as great as Rabbi Akiva Eiger, he should, in fact, worry about his kovod. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger responded, that's where it says, v'salamta mehem by Hashava Saveda, pomem sha'ata misalem. Once in a while, if it's not, it's beneath your dignity, you should not get involved in Hashava Saveda. But here it says, Al Tisalam, there's no exceptions. You always have to somehow hold on as much as you can to relatives, no matter what they're doing. Now, in the case of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, there wasn't an intermarriage. So you can't extrapolate necessarily, but there's a principle, whenever possible, to hold on to a family member. Now, again, it may depend to some extent on whether the family member is somehow Tinok Shenishbu or not, or somehow doing it because he can't control himself, or doing it out of spite, which hardly ever exists these days. Some disagree with Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's pesach, and some say to bring them close for a variety of reasons. One, maybe the non-Jewish partner will convert. Of course, conversions, most of the conversions in America today are probably for the sake of marriage. Most of them are probably invalid, because they don't have what we call in our language Kabbalah Samitzvahs. And certainly to perform such a conversion, we require a full Kabbalah Samitzvahs, the complete acceptance of Shabbos and Kashrus, etc., which is rare in the broader picture. There's a fascinating tshuva of Moshe, Yoredei Chelek Aleph Siman Kuf Samach, where he suggests that as long as there is a partial Kabbalah Samitzvahs and the remainder that's not accepted is because the person thinks that it's not really required, and the rabbi who is requiring it is really doing something beyond the actual letter of the law, and he thinks that way because there's so many people who are known as Orthodox who are not keeping a particular rule. So Rav Moshe writes, well, then maybe there's a chance such a person is Jewish, and Rav Moshe even recommended that certain rabbis get involved in these cases. You know, I wouldn't follow that sock nowadays, but Rav Moshe felt they're going to intermarry anyway. This was a chance that they considered to be Jewish, and presumably there may be a chance that such a conversion can take place, and therefore there may be another additional reason to hang on to such relatives, even though there was an intermarriage. Question number 7. Chatzitza shaylos, one at a time. Spray tanning, at times the entire body. It's not a chatzitza. It's clear in the Shulchan Aruch, in Yerodeh Siman Kuf Sarichas, that if a woman dyes her hair, she's permitted to go to the mikvah lechatchila with the dye on her hair. And even though the hair, according to the Shulchan Aruch, is treated as an independent unit, and if all the hair is dyed, it's the same as all the body is dyed, nonetheless, it's permissible. And the reason it's permissible, even lechatchila, because you have two things going for you. Number one, it's what's called linoi, for beautification purposes. And number two, it's ein bo mamish. There's nothing there. It's just absorbed into the hair. It does not extend above the surface of the hair. The same is true of spray tanning. It's absorbed in the skin. It does not extend above the surface. It's there for beautification purposes. And therefore, I'm not recommending you do this, but if a woman does it, it's not considered a chatzitza at all. That's A. B, gel nail polish thicker than regular nail polish and designed to stay on longer and difficult to get off. This is different from A. A, as I said, is ein bo mamish, and B is yesh bo mamish. If you look in the Aruch HaShulchan, in Siman Kuf Samach Aleph Sif Hei, he says it's a chatzitza, even for Netilas Yadayim. It's an Aruch Haim, even Netilas Yadayim. The Mishnah Berurah there in Sifkot Yud Bey sounds like he holds it's not considered to be a chatzitza. This is all b'diavad, but lechatchila, in my view, it should certainly be removed. According to Aruch HaShulchan, it's a shaila even b'diavad, quanta mishnah brura not, but the chatchil, it seems to me, it should be removed. And I know that there are many rabbanim who disagree with me, especially the Eretz Yisrael digger rabbanim, but I feel that certainly it should be removed if it's at all possible. Now, b'di'eved, you know, a woman comes in, she can't get it off, then I think we would allow it. Shasatcha, can't get it off, we would allow it. She refuses to take it off, we would allow it. But the chatchila, in my view, it should be removed. And question C, perhaps even more serious, eyelash extensions. From Moshe the Tshuva in Chelek Gimel Siman Samach Beis, even false eyelashes proper, which are there permanently, should not be placed because of chatzitza reasons, unless, as he puts it, she really needs it. Perhaps if a woman has no eyelashes at all, then she doesn't look, you know, even regular. So it's a very big shasat chak, so no, it's there permanently, so it's much better. But here, eyelash extensions, no one needs eyelash extensions. If you have an eyelash, it doesn't have to be that long. It's not so necessary, number one. Number two, they're not permanent. They come off. If you go on the website, you'll see how often they come off, what it costs to come off, and how on and off. Therefore, it seems to me clear that the chatchila, she should not go in with eyelash extensions. It must be removed. Again, b'di'eved, we try very hard not to say that a tefillah is no good b'di'eved. There are some extenuating circumstance leniencies, but the chatchila should be removed. Question 8. If onions were cut with a fleshik knife and fried in a milchik frying pan with a minimum amount of spray, and the pan was eino ben yomo, can we rely on the opinions that I'm making, not the kasha of the pan, Yad Yehuda beis Meir? It's a complicated question. The busy Yad Yehuda and Simon Tzadi Hei Sifkot and Tezayin, which I believe the questioner is referring to, based on the Shulchan Aruch and Yoradeh Simon Tzadi Gimel Sif Aleph, that by Eino Ben Yomo, which means it hasn't been used in 24 hours, the tam, the taste which is absorbed in such a pot, is considered what you call hetera. It's considered hetero, it's considered to be permissible, because right now it's permissible. And therefore it's what we call a not bar not the hetero. When it comes to a not bar not the hetero, which means it's a second taste and it's still heter, there's room to be lenient. So therefore, in this particular case, we can suggest that the pan was Eino Ben Yomo, so whatever milchika stuff was in there is considered to be pogum. It's considered to be something which has been blemished. It's not tasty. So even though the fleshik knife makes the onion the equivalent of a ben yomo, according to some achmirim, even though it's the knife even any ben yomo as well, where machmir v'dov acharif, nonetheless, it only bangs into taste in the pan, which is eino ben yomo, which is considered to be pogum. And the very fact that it's pogum makes it considered to be hetera no matter what. I mean, all basa b'cholim is hetera, but there's still certain chumras, but over here, since it's pogum, we can be more lenient, and therefore we can suggest that the pan need not be kashered in such a case. I want to add something, that who says that the fleshik knife is really fleshik? We once had a case like this in our house. One of my sons cut an onion with a fleshik knife, with a milchik knife, and he put the onions into the cholent. It was a whole shayla with a whole table full of Talmidei Chachamim. And the hetter we came up with was, we asked if this knife that he used, he took a plain knife out of the drawer. This is a plain knife out of the drawer. That knife was used at the table. It's a table knife. We asked if anyone ever knew that these knives were used in what we call a kli rishon. A kli rishon means it was placed into a pot of dairy. A pot of dairy, whether the top pot was on the fire or even taken off the fire, but the original pot or pan, was it ever put into such a thing? And the answer was, to the best of everyone's recollection, no. So although we call it a milchik knife, it wasn't really milchik, because it never touched anything in a kli rishon. Now it may have touched something in a kli sheni, which is a dove or gush, which according to some of Farshim is considered to be the equivalent of kli rishon. We don't pass on the way of mikra, then the Ramos make on the shayla. On that basis, we're matter the chon. Here too, the fact that the fleshig, a knife, was used to cut the onion, the chances are, again, it's not clear what kind of knife was used. Chances are, if it's a typical knife in a typical drawer, a silverware drawer, it's not really fleshig. Let's go on. Question number 9. When davening for a chola, we include the language of Besog Shachola Yisrael, language of the Shulchan Aruch, Yerodea Shin Lamed Hei Sivav, which seems to indicate that this should be done even in the presence of the chola. Olecha. This is correct. How do we resolve this with Moshe's tefillah for Miriam, which does not contain this lashon? Okay. One needs to only look in Rashi, in Parshas, and the Parshas Balosa to come up with a possible answer. Rashi says he was Mekatzer, so people shouldn't say he was Marich. What's wrong with that? So the Netziv, in Emek HaSifri, Emek HaNetziv and the Sifri, that says that the reason why it shouldn't be Marich is because Moshe Rabbeinu's tefillah was so strong that as soon as he'd finish, the result would come. So the longer he was Marech, the longer Miriam had to suffer with Taras. So he explains that Rashi quotes from Chazal. So that's why he was so Mekater. But maybe everybody else should, in fact, throw in Pesach Shachol Yisrael. B. In addition, Shlomo Zalman said that saying Refuah Shlema to the patient suffices the tefillah. He does not mention the need for Pesach. Would that be enough if one intends it as a good wish without thinking it as a tefillah that Hashem may grant you? I think the answer is, of course, a foolish thing is not just a good wish. Of course, we hope that Hashem should give the refuah shleima, even though we don't spell it out. But Rav Shlomo Zalman says it suffices a tefillah. It's enough. Not a perfect tefillah. The perfect tefillah should be refuah shleima b'soch shar chol yisrael, as we say in the Mishaberach. Question 10. If a family goes away for Shabbos to relatives, but they are sleeping up the block by friends, where should they light Shabbos candles? Where they are sleeping or where they're eating the meals? Does it make a difference if they are eating in their relative's house or in the catering hall? Is halacha the same for Hanukkah candles as well? Big fights about this in recent poskim. I'll quote from the Sefer Piskei Tshuvos in Reish Sama Gimel, Oth, Choptes and Lamed, who makes the following remark. Today, we have electric lights everywhere. So if a woman is just going to light candles, it's a serious child, it should be a bracha levatola. Shraga betira mayahani, it's light outside. The answer is that if the woman lights candles at the place where they're eating, it adds to the Shabbos ambiance, tosefes ora v'simcha, as the Mishnah Berurah with it quotes in Sifkat Mem from the Magen Avraham Tazayin. That only applies to the place where they are eating. So therefore, there's really no alternative to lighting candles but to light where they are eating, because if you light candles where you're not eating, he feels it'd be a bracha levatola if the electric lights are on from before. Now, there's an alternative to this, which is worthwhile every single week. So it happens in my house. On the way out to shul, before my wife lights candles, I flick the switch to the chandelier above the dining room table off, and then right back on again. If my wife remembers, she does it again before she lights, so she'll be even better. She'll be coming from her. And this is an integral part of the Hadlakas HaNeros. And the bracha goes not only on the candles, but on the electric light as well. And the Piskei Tshuvos quotes this there as the proper way to do it there in the footnotes. And that can be done even in such a case. In other words, they could light the electric light where they're staying for Shabbos, where they're sleeping, and then go to the place where they're eating and light Neros Shabbos, because you're having a combination of both. Of course, the preferable place for lighting Neros Shabbos is a place which is your private or semi-private place, not in the public place. And that's why when the person is lighting the electric candles in the house up the block where they're sleeping, try to find a place which is as private as possible. You may have a private bathroom, or maybe there's a private little foyer in front of the bedroom you're staying. Or if there's a bathroom off the foyer that you're using, or even if you're in your own bedroom, either a small nightlight or these new kinds of lights that you can turn around to make them darker later on. That's where the electric light should be lit. That's a very important halacha to know. That's enough. Mikra din, that's sufficient, because the place where you're sleeping is really your place. The place where you're eating is not so much your place. It's obviously you're going away to some other place, which is not really yours. It's your host's. True, you're eating there, but it's not really yours, especially if you're going to a catering hall, which is totally meant for large numbers of people. It's not private at all. Women want the light and arrows. They're not happy with electric, even no matter you tell them that it could be yotzer with electric. In my view, electric is any kind of light, whether it be incandescent or be fluorescent or these sodium, halogen. They're all good in my view. Not everyone agrees. But if the woman wants to light a nair, as we said earlier, the place to do it is where she's eating. Now, it should be put in the place where she is eating. If it's a friend's house down the block, she should light it where the friend lights, either on the table or near the table. In a catering hall, they often will not let you do that. Sometimes they have a special room off to the side. I call that room a towering inferno. That's a brachal of atala mamish. According to Pisket Chuvis, it's not appropriate if it's a pinar chokka shekem at veino niret, almost not visible. Even that's no good. If it's not on your table proper, they won't allow that, at least on a table which is nearby to your table. Same as we have candles in our house. It's not on the table. It could be on a little break front near the table, you know, a few feet away. That would suffice. I was once at a bar mitzvah, and I convinced them that they allowed myself and another Rav, since we were the Rabbonim, to have the Rebbetzin's light literally at our table. Everybody else was a little further to the side, but it wasn't in a totally separate room. Better on your table proper. Now, the idea of not leaving a candle unattended also comes to play. If you're staying at friends and there's someone in the house, that's one thing. If there's no one in the house, it's not so safe to leave candles. There have been a few tragedies recently coming from these kinds of situations on Shabbos, and I would be hesitant to leave the candles by themselves, and that's the reason why the candles proper should be lit in the place where you're eating, and you fulfill the mitzvah with the electric lights in the place where you are sleeping. So what should be done, to summarize, electric lights should be lit where you're sleeping, and you have in mind that the bracha that you make there should include the candles you'll light later on. If you know for a fact that the candles can be lit later on in the proper place, you can postpone the bracha until later, which women like to do, to make the bracha on the candles. But if you're not sure, make the bracha earlier. You have in mind, if you'll be able to do it properly later on, it should include that as well. And if not, you go to with the electric lights. What about Chanukah? Chanukah is different. Chanukah, your mokum sheino is ikar, where you sleep is the main place these days. Given our present circumstances, your sleep is considered a more kavua for you. When you eat, you're just eating at someone's house as a guest. So that's not so much yours. The Mishnah Berurah writes in Tuf Resh Ayin Zayin Sif Katan, your days, I believe it is, that if a person is going away for a meal, you can't light there where you want to eat supper. No, you have to go back home and light where you're going to sleep. That's halach with respect to Ner Chanukah. Question 11. The minhag in Armenian is that a woman in Avelis may say Kaddish only at the same time as a man saying Kaddish. Priests provide guidelines for which man should be appointed to say Kaddish with her if no man present is saying Kaddish already. For example, should only a man who is a Yosem say Kaddish with her? If a man's parents are alive, does he need permission from them to say Kaddish with this woman? Is it at all preferable for the Mara D'Asr to say Kaddish with her? Or would a Ger Tzedek be preferable? Since the word preferable is used twice, I'll begin with that. What's preferable? She shouldn't say Kaddish at all. That's preferable. When I grew up, I never heard a woman say Kaddish. It was unheard of. Unheard of. I'm sorry to say that it's part of the general egalitarian push of the last generation or two. it's not coming from ancient sources where they had it in certain places. It's coming from that. I'm sorry to say it that way, but that's just the reality. And if you look in the Pitzchei Tshuva, in Yerodea Simen Shinai and Vav Sivkot and Gimel, long before feminism, he discouraged very strongly any woman from saying Kaddish because of Chalishos HaMenhogim. You're weakening the custom that it wasn't done. And weakening customs is a terrible, terrible thing. Now, given the fact that this is a custom in the shul, presumably they cannot eliminate it, so we have to deal with the Rabbi Miyuto. It's a bad custom, but how do you minimize the negativity? So yes, someone who is not blessed with two parents should say the Kaddish. Asking permission, that's another thing. When I grew up, no one knew our two parents had Kaddish. Nobody. Now they started a new fair to ask permission. I'm not in favor. It was something which was never done in the old days. I don't like it. Nonetheless, if there's nobody else in the room who does not have two parents, and the woman's about to say Kaddish on her own, I would say that whoever jumps in to say Kaddish with her, even if he has two parents, is called a kodem zocha lemitzvah, to fulfill the custom of that shul that she shouldn't say it by herself. And although there's a little ayin hara, shome mitzvah l'yodah davara, not for him, not for his parents, they should live long lives. If you look in the Chavas Yor, there, it's quoted in the Pischei Tshuva, he says, since it's pirsum, yesh limchos. Since this kaddish is being said in a public fashion, we should protest and not allow it. Now, if the woman is saying it by herself, there's tremendous pirsum. If someone else says it with her, well, he says it in a loud voice, there is either no pirsum, if she says it in an undertone, or at least less pirsum if her voice is somewhat louder. We once had a case in our own shul, and the woman agreed to say it in a low voice. We couldn't hear her, certainly in the men's section. So we didn't make a protest, even though it was against our minhag. But, Chalishos HaMenhogim is a bad thing. But the primary reason for the Chavos Yor was because of the pirsum, yesh limchos. So I'm against it even without pirsum, even in an undertone. But a macha, a protest to try to stop it, does not apply if there's no pirsum, if it's said in an undertone. Question 12. A family wants to rent a home for family get-together for Chol HaMoed Pesach, the first time they will walk into the property of Chol HaMoed. Many of these properties supply free food, such as non-kosher champagne, fancy beer, whatever, all kinds of stuff. The family called the property management team and asked if they could remove all food. Answer was, it's yours to enjoy. If you don't want it, then leave it in the closet. A, can you rent such a property on Pesach? It depends. It depends. Does that food belong to you? My guess, an educated guess, I may not be right, is that you may have ordered this room, you may have even paid for this room, but nonetheless, it's not really yours, if I use that expression, yours as renters, until Chol HaMoed. Very likely there's someone else living there. If it's a popular place, there's somebody else living there until Chol HaMoed. So what they put there is not yours, and they put it, the family leaves on the first day Pesach, Goyim, and then they put there the second day Pesach, they put in chametz sticker stuff. It's not yours. Your time only starts the next day. It's time sharing. So therefore the food is not yours. If the food is not yours, then you may rent it, but, there's a big but, the minute you walk into the place, you have to do what we call a bedikas chametz, which includes throwing out all the chametz immediately. This is found in Siman Tuf, Lamed Hey, Sif Aleph, Mishnah Berurah, Sif Katan Beis. Immediately. No dilly-dallying. Before you put any, you come out of the car, the first thing you do, the first person who walks in, launch it into an immediate bedikas chametz, could be helped by others, and the first thing they do is throw all the chametz out into the garbage, some garbage can far away, which does not belong to them in any which way. That's what we do. This is what has to be done. This way they really never took possession of it, and they're never living in a place where there's chametz strewn all over the place, which is an effective violation of the bedikas chametz principle. Found in the Shulchan Aruch, based in the Gemara, has the bedikas chametz on Pesach. Now, the question was, if yes, do you need to sell the chametz erev Pesach that you may farm when you arrive? I don't think it works. I can't sell the Brooklyn Bridge. As I said before, it's not mine, to my knowledge, an erev Pesach, and therefore I can't sell it. If someone has a different kind of a contract, they can sell it erev Pesach, but I don't think that's true in these kinds of situations. C, If it's real chametz, you have to dispose of it when you arrive, absolutely, immediately. D, all the appliances are clean, they are chametz to contrave, can they soak in the oven on Chol HaMoed? The answer is yes. You can't kasha with Hagola on Pesach, but Liban works, Simon Tofnun Bey, Sif Aleph, and self-clean is considered to be Liban. E, related to the topic, what should someone do regarding Bedika and selling chametz when renting a hotel room for Pesach from a kosher to Pesach hotel program? Well, a little complicated. It seems to me that any decent hotel, I assume he's going to a decent hotel, has professional cleaning between occupants. It's clear that they cleaned it many times and well, and there's no chametz there whatsoever. If you look in the Chochma Shlomo, Siman Tov Lamed Gimel Sifyot Aleph, he says, if they swept it for 3 days, it becomes a, quote, Mokom She'ein Machnisin Bo Chometz. In effect, it becomes a place to which Chometz is not introduced. Of course, they introduced it 2 weeks ago, but they did a fabulous cleaning job, so now there's nothing left. I think it applies to hotel rooms in general, and therefore, you cannot do Bedika and selling Chometz there in the hotel. Rather, you do what you always do. You sell the Chometz in your house, and you check in your house the night before you leave, as normal. If you happen to be leaving your house all Arba Asar, the night before Pesach, then you would do even make a bracha. If not, without a bracha. And in the hotel, so it seems to me, you want to do a bedik, I can't stop you, but I wouldn't make a bracha. Because I think, strictly speaking, as the Chochma Shlomo says, it's a Mokom She'ein Machnisin Bo Chometz. Now, there's another alternative, which is a little bit counterproductive to what they did for you. Come in with all your Cheerios and your cookies and your crackers with all your kids and make a royal mess. And then, you absolutely have to have a Bedikas Chametz Mika Radin. You have to make a bracha. That's true. But that's, of course, a very problematic way to enter into the Yontif by creating it for yourself an extra headache. I do not believe it's required. You can fulfill the mitzvah of Bedikas Chametz before you leave the house. And the hotel is considered a makom She'ein Machnisin Bo Chometz, as we learn in Chochma Shlomo. Question number 13. Regarding walking a chosn or kala down the aisle, if the chosn or kala is an orphan, only one parent is still living, who should walk them down? Just the living parent. The living parent with a sibling and a spouse. If the kala or chosn have a specific request of the living parent and a sibling, walk her down. Is that okay? How important is this idea in the first place? So the answer, of course, is it's all minhagim, and therefore, minhag number one is prevalent, minhag number two is prevalent. Minhag number three is, in certain Hasidic communities, they insist that a couple should walk them down, a couple that was on both in their first marriage. So therefore, for example, if Kala's mother passed away and the father remarried, so in our circles it's common that the father and the stepmother will walk the Kala down, not in Hasidic circles. What they'll do is, instead of the father walking his own daughter down, the father will walk down, if they have this custom, the others walk down with his wife. And then the Kala's sibling and spouse, who in their first marriage, will walk down with the Kala. I've seen that. I never understood why. So I saw in the Hasidic Svarim, that's what they do. Obviously, if the Chasam Kala have a particular preference, you should listen to them, unless it's completely against a clear custom in their family. 14. If neither the chos nor kala want to have shever brachos for the whole week after the wedding, is there any minimum amount that they would need to have? In Europe, they only had on Shabbos. Only on Shabbos. Well, they don't want even on Shabbos. They're doing a festive meal anyway, but they do not have a minyan for shever brachos. How important is it to find people to come and to complete the minyan, especially if the minyan are random people who do not increase the level of joy for either the chos nor kala? The answer is as follows. There's no obligation to have shever brachos. It's not an obligation. All the svarim say it's proper to have shever brachos to get a bracha. Who doesn't want to get a bracha? Everyone wants. Well, if they don't, they don't. But it's proper to convince them, to persuade them to have shever brachos. Even on Shabbos, it's no chova. If they don't want, they don't have to have it. But again, you should certainly be persuaded in that kind of case. If there is no minyan, says in Shulchan Aruch, Evan Ezer Siman Sanan on the base, you only make Asher Bara. That's all. You make Asher Bara, only the last of the Sheva Brachas. Obviously, it's better to get a minyan and to make all Sheva Brachas, but you need what we call a Panu Chadashis, which means at least one of the people who was there was not at the wedding or previous Sheva Brachas, and you would want one who should increase the level of joy for the Chasn and or the Kala, and therefore a random person presumably would not count. Once you have one person who's Panu Chadashis, the other people to make up the minyan can be quote-unquote random people. 15. I was paying a shivavit to a Sephardic man. When I got up to leave, I wanted to give him a hug. When he told me that his chacham, I told him it was not appropriate for an oval to hug or kiss guests in the shiva house. Is this a perversion? But it's only marginally observant oval of the idea that an oval not kissing his children during shiva? Or is there indeed a such a halacha or inyan? Would it apply to Ashkenazi oval as well? I don't think that this custom comes from the idea of not hugging or kissing a child. That's in the Yoredes and Shintayal Sefal because of Simcha. No. I think that those who prohibit it consider it to be what you call Shelas Shalom. Shelas Shalom is also prohibited with respect to an Avil. But if you ask me, this is not Shelas Shalom. This is Nicham Avelim. This is, very often you see, especially when it comes to women, that a woman will walk into a Shavas, to the Avela, will start getting up, or the Menachemas will start bending down, and they'll hug each other, and they're going to start crying again. This is a Nicham Avelim. This is not a classic Shelas Shalom. So I thought that this custom, although it, I don't want to use the word perversion about a Minig Yisrael, I would call it an extension, not of the idea of kissing the children, but an idea of Shelas Shalom. From where I'm coming, it's an inappropriate extension, but I don't know what goes on. Maybe in Sephardic communities, this kind of hug has a different connotation, which would be considered Shelas Shalom. For those of us who don't have that custom, it need not necessarily be adopted. Question number 16. A kala wants to use a grandmother's ring for a wedding. The grandmother is no longer alive, and the ring is with a cousin who will allow them to use it for the wedding, for it to be returned after. Is there any way for this to be done? Is there a kinyan that the chosn should make on the ring? I strongly, strongly recommend that you do not do this. Very bad idea. Of course, we all know the custom of Matana Manas Taharzir, the cousin will give it to this individual, to this kala, to give to her chosn, has to go back to the cousin. But people aren't such experts when it comes to these things. Not experts. I'm learning this year in the yeshiva, learning Masechta Sukkah. There's a Mishnah Berurah in Siman Tov Resh Nun Ches Sifkat Mem Beis that says, people are not experts in Matana Manas Taharzir. The relevant situation is giving an Arba Minim to someone to give it back. We try to avoid that because people are not experts. Not expert to give it, not expert to give it back. It comes from the Eshel Levon, Prima Godim, Sifkat Nyud Beis. So it's very not advisable to do this for a wedding. We have to have a real Matana Manas Taharzir. They both have in mind completely. That means that the cousin to the kala and the kala to the chosn and then the kala to give it, going to have to give it back to the cousin. Or Manas Taharzir. This is not a proper thing to do. Question number 17. Oh, is there a kinyan that the chosn should make on the ring? In theory, yes, but in practice, no. 17. Is it okay to get a marriage license during Sheva Brachos? If the chosn and kala don't live in the same state and the only time within 60 days of their wedding is that they'll be together in the state in which they're getting married is the day before the wedding, is it preferable that they go together then or can they do it during Sheva Brachos? Now, there are many states in the union. From my understanding, the state of New York, number one, to perform a wedding, you require a license from the state, which I received many years ago. Number two, it's a misdemeanor for a rabbi to perform a wedding in New York State without a marriage license by the state of New York. So, I tell every chosn kala when I meet them, please provide me with a marriage license at the wedding that you've procured beforehand. Shasat chak, such as this case, or they forgot to do it, they ran out of time, da-da-da-da-da-da. So, you can perhaps hope I'm not speaking in an illegal fashion. Perhaps in such a difficult case, we can rely on them to get it immediately during the Shavuot Brachos. To get it the day before the wedding, as we know, is against the famous minhag not to see each other for the last week before they got married. This minhag has no real source. Rabbi Aryeh Kaplanzal, who knew everything, could only find them in Hagei Chabad as a source for it. Nonetheless, I think it's a good custom. I think it's a nice custom. And it seems to me that if they tell you they'll get it the day after the wedding or 2 days later, we can be makel to do the wedding without having the marriage license. But it should be emphasized that it should come right away. And in advance, you should tell them in advance not to come to the situation. And in the case that we're discussing, where they're in different states, he's not going to be there within 60 days, and there's no choice in that situation. But that should be only an exception when there's no alternative. 18. A couple wants to use a ksuba with a Hebrew on top and English on the bottom. The top part is the same wording as an ordinary ksuba with a place for Adim to sign as they would on any other ksuba. The bottom is a flowery expression of their mutual love and desire to build a home based on love and mutual respect as a tradition of our Jewish heritage. As long as they both understand that the bottom isn't the translation of the top and the ksuba is part as explained to them, can they use such a document? Technically speaking, there's no violation. I would say about this, Ein ruach hachamim nocha himenu. And we try to avoid these things. We should be discouraged from using this. If the Rav cannot discourage them, there's no other ksuba around, we can rely upon this in a pinch because there's no technical violation. 19. Concerning drinking on Purim, is the mitzvah just wine and only during the meal, or any alcoholic beverage at any time during Purim? This question divides into different parts. The first question, is it only wine? Absolutely yes, only wine. Look in the Bir Halacha and Siman Tofresh Tadihei Sivbeis, and in the Mikroi Kodesh Siman Mem Dalet, it's only wine. And the answer, the reason for that is simple. Bir Halacha asks, how can it be we are so much against drunkenness? Drunkenness is terrible. The answer is, it's to commemorate what happened through the Mishteh HaYayin. It's explicit in the Megillah, more than once. It was a Mishteh HaYayin. It's to a Mishteh of wine that the two suitors of Esther Amalka led to the undoing of Haman and the saving of the Jews. Only Mishteh HaYayin. No other drink will do the trick. No other drink will be the fulfillment of the mitzvah of the Vesumi B'Puria, in my opinion. Only Mishteh HaYayin. Now, if you look on the Dirshu there, footnote 16, they quote some people disagree. Seem to indicate that, well, maybe you have to have a little bit of wine, but the remainder of your stupor can be induced by other intoxicating beverages. In my opinion, it's not correct. It's chayav besumi ad layoda. It's only with wine. Okay. On the other hand, only during the meal? No, not at all. On the contrary, according to the Ramah, it seems to me, given our custom, it cannot be done during the meal. Let me explain. The Ramah writes there that the proper custom is to fall asleep after drinking the wine, and when you fall asleep, you're ad layoda between Or Haman and Baruch Mordechai. But you have to fall asleep during the day, as the Dirshu there says in footnote 9. We have a custom that the Suda's Purim goes into the night. There may be a very good reason for the custom. If you look at Meshech Chochma on the Megillah, he suggests the reason is that Haman wanted to kill us on one day, but his day started in the morning and ended in the morning, by the Nachrim, almost all of them. So therefore he wanted to kill us from the 13th until the 14th morning. So Ayom HaShanachu was the 14th morning until the 15th in the morning. It was a minute to extend the Suda into the night. Very nice. If you do that, you can't, as you fall asleep at the table, which is, you know, I guess some can do, but most don't do. So you're not going to be able to do it. So the proper way, if you ask me, is to come home from shul, have a little wine with your breakfast, go to try to fall asleep right away. Many people who are up late at night, maybe got up early in the morning, can fall asleep rather easily. You fall asleep for 1 minute, it's enough to be ad layoda. You fulfill the mitzvah of what we call mishteh. You may mishteh. And then as you may simcha, you may mishteh v'simcha. Simcha is a typical Yom Tov meal. Bread and meat and wine. Bread is a machlokes. Meat is a machlokes, but that's what we pass on the halacha based on the Rambam and the Taz who say the Rambam says meat and the Taz says bread. So that's simcha. So you have another cup of wine. Okay. Two cups of wine, one in the morning and one in the evening, before it gets dark, will not cause any significant damage. Now, at night, forget about it. Anytime during Purim, at night is no mitzvah whatsoever. I want to end with the following. The Bria Halacha says there, if by drinking and intoxication, will be mezalzel in a single mitzvah. You'll mess up the Tilas Adayim or benching, or you will have what they call Kalas Rosh, inappropriate levity, then you should not drink that much. You should do what I said earlier, have one cup of wine in the morning and try to fall asleep, one cup of wine in the Suda, and that's all. In our generation, we've seen that intoxication on Purim has led to death. That's no exaggeration. Death, DWI. Death, people driving when they shouldn't be driving. And you can't trust somebody necessarily to know when to make a right decision. And even if it's not behind the wheel, he could be walking and be hit by somebody because he doesn't know where he's walking. And there are people who get sick from Purim. There are people who, unfortunately, publicly are vomiting. It's a violation. It's Kalas Rosh. It's a Chilul Hashem. So therefore, it seems to me that the proper way to fulfill the mitzvah, yes, it's a mitzvah of Mishte V'Simcha. Yes, only with wine, only by day. Cup of wine in the morning and fall asleep if you can. Cup of wine in the Suda to fulfill the mitzvah of Simcha. In this spirit, I wish everybody a Freilichen Purim.
Thank you, Rebbe, very much. We wish you also a Freilichen Purim to all the Rabbanim. We hope we can call upon Rebbe in the near future. Thank you very, very much. Zayge Bench, everyone. Take care. Bye-bye.